From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. It's a long process, electing a president, but yesterday, the people of New Hampshire took the first big step. On this edition of Fresh Air, we look at yesterday's New Hampshire primary and what the results mean for both the Republican and Democratic candidates. We'll talk with Christopher Hitchens, the Washington editor for Harper's Magazine, and with Roger Simon, syndicated columnist for the Baltimore Sun. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews The Spyglass Tree, the sequel to Albert Murray's critically acclaimed autobiographical novel, Train Whistle Guitar. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. New Hampshire election officials have released the official results from yesterday's Republican primary, and they show that President Bush didn't win by as much as the media thought he did. Instead of an 18-point margin, 58% to 40%, the official figures show the president ahead by 16 points. The New Hampshire Secretary of State's office said that the actual results show President Bush with 53% to Patrick Buchanan's 37%. Officials said the discrepancy appeared to be because a substantial number of Republican write-ins for other candidates weren't counted in the initial reports. President Bush was in Tennessee today to begin his campaign for the South. Mr. Bush said he's satisfied with his victory in the New Hampshire primary, but he added that he's ready to roll up his sleeves to confront GOP challenger Pat Buchanan. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In his first public comment since last night's results came in, Mr. Bush said he would have liked to have done better, but asked, what's wrong with an 18-point victory?
I'm satisfied with the results, and now we're down here, and we're going to take this guy on in every single state. I'd have to do a little definition of who it is, because all I did was lay back and get hammered by these Democrats, and to some degree by Pat. And so it's a new ball game.
The president was in Tennessee visiting the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Tennessee is among the southern states holding their primaries on Super Tuesday, March 10th. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The nation's most talked about non-candidate for president says yesterday's New Hampshire primary results show even Republicans believe President Bush is on the wrong track. New York Governor Mario Cuomo also examined the results of the write-in campaign for him, as Paul Rosenthal of member station WAMC reports.
Cuomo says he understands why he only received 3% of the vote, far below what his supporters had hoped for. He says he simply was not running.
Given the fact that I was not a candidate, I am not the least bit surprised at whatever the low result is of a draft effort.
And Cuomo is dismissing calls to jump into the race now for the same reason he declined a bid for the White House in the first place.
I don't have a budget, and that's the end of it. I can't go any further. I don't have a budget. I am totally focused on getting the budget.
Cuomo says even if a budget is passed by mid-March, he could not join in, as the primary process would virtually be over. As for those candidates in the race, Cuomo says Paul Tsongas and Bill Clinton will run strong in the South. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Rosenthal in Albany, New York.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 5 points to close at 3,230. Declines led advances by a margin of 9-7 in heavy trading of 233 million shares. This is NPR News. The United Nations Security Council issued a warning to Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein today, saying that Iraq faces serious consequences if it fails to comply with UN weapons resolutions. The council is sending Chief Weapons Monitor Rolf Ekeas to Baghdad tonight to present the demand in person. Unlike a UN resolution, the statement is not legally binding, but U.S. Ambassador Thomas Pickering said today that it amounted to an ultimatum. Pickering declined to say what the council would do if Iraq still refuses to cooperate. A study in today's New England Journal of Medicine warns that people who overuse certain asthma medicines are more likely to get fatal or near-fatal asthma attacks. But as NPR's Richard Harris reports, the drug itself may not be to blame.
People with asthma can save their lives by inhaling drugs that open their breathing passages. But the new study shows that people who rely on these drugs too heavily could die as a result. Researchers at McGill University in Montreal say the drugs are apparently safe at the recommended doses, but doctors should watch out if their patients start using too much. That could be a sign that the underlying disease is getting worse. The inhalants do a great job at treating the serious symptoms of the disease, and as a result, some people don't seek further medical care. But the inhalants don't treat the root cause of asthma, and if the disease gets out of control, it can be deadly. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The Boeing company said today that it will cut 6,500 jobs this year because of cuts in military spending and reductions in the production of passenger jets. The company said it would eliminate at least 5,000 jobs in the Puget Sound area of Washington and the rest in Wichita, Kansas. Officials said Boeing will reduce the workforce with a combination of attrition and layoffs. A company spokesman blamed the cuts on last October's cancellation of three missile programs and cutbacks in productions of the 737 passenger jet. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. New Hampshire is returning to normal after a frenetic, grueling presidential primary in which 62 candidates and 3,000 members of the press corps descended on the state. And now the country's reflecting on yesterday's results. Are people ready for the uncharismatic Paul Tsongas? Is Pat Buchanan's 40% of the vote a serious threat to George Bush? We asked journalist Christopher Hitchens to come in and share his thoughts on yesterday's presidential primary. Hitchens is Washington editor for Harper's and a columnist for The Nation. He went to New Hampshire to see how polls were defining the campaigns. I asked him what he made of yesterday's results.
Well, when I was up in New Hampshire, I formed the impression that what the electors were basically saying was, give us one good reason and we'll vote against George Bush. We'll vote for anyone, in a sense, who can symbolize our disillusionment. And I think that they did vote for pretty much anyone. I think that the fact that someone like Patrick Buchanan, who's basically a chat show host, a full-blown Beltway merchant, an absolute Washingtonian, with a record of being both soft on crime and soft on fascism, is an extraordinary outcome. But if you break it down, as we owe it to the polling industry to do, and look at the results, it seems people simply voted for him because they don't like the president. Much the same applies, I think, to the way that the Democratic voters cast their ballots. They seem to have been applying a wholly new test that's been invented by the political campaigning industry, that of electability. A sort of pseudo-objective concept, but one that privileges, you might say, candidates who look as if they might one day win. Again, you have people saying, we simply want someone to land a punch on George Bush.
Did you find the polls helpful either in predicting the results of this election or in helping you understand the concerns of the voters in New Hampshire? Did it give you a sense of this presidential primary?
Well, I mean, I don't know how the pollsters can live with themselves. Even in the terms of their own business, they utterly failed to foreshadow what became the salient point, at least of the New Hampshire campaign, which was the remarkable attraction exerted by Paul Tsongas.
Well, if the polls then missed in New Hampshire, as you say, and missed several months ago in Pennsylvania in the race between Wofford and Thornburg, why have they gotten such an elevated position?
Well, because I think that they conformed to the need of the mass media for something that could be called objective. In other words, what could be less ideological, less value-laden than simply asking people what their intentions are and then calibrating the results? It sounds fine. I mean, I think, though, it has become an intervention in the political process and a grave distortion of it. And it's simply no good at evaluating the process by which actual ideas are formed, discussed, exchanged, and adopted.
Do you think of it as a rather hypochondriacal way to understand election politics? It's rather like taking your temperature all the time.
It is very much like that, and as any parent knows, you'll always find that it's just very slightly higher than you thought. and you can worry yourself into a terrific state exactly that way. There's always a little variation to be monitored. By the time I left New Hampshire, I think people were getting a new poll almost every day. All the conversation around the bar in the journalist's hotel was always about polling. And all the calls people were getting from their home offices in Washington and New York and elsewhere we're all about, you know, how are the polls doing? The intro paragraph to most stories was about movement up or down in the opinion polls. The whole thing was a complete substitute for going out and talking to people. I think the same is true of the candidates. Look how awkward most of them look. I would have to say for Pat Buchanan, this doesn't apply to him. But most of them, they look absolutely ghastly when actually going out and meeting the people, the fixed grins, the embarrassment, the pretended concern and so forth. What they want to do is rush back and talk to their polling advisors and say, tell me what the people are saying. They don't want to go out and find out for themselves. And no more do the members of my profession.
Is there then such a thing as a polling industry? That there's really an industry growing up around this issue?
Oh, yes, there is. For example, you know, if the New York Times and ABC want to commission a serious poll, the least it's going to cost them is $50,000. I've checked this out. It's a serious pollster will charge you for an in-depth interview, $50 an interview, and you can't really interview less than 1,000 people for a proper sample. And if you want to ask more complicated questions and spread it around a bit, it'll be more. So talking about quite a lot of money, and what they get for it is a terrific saving. I'm talking now about the New York Times. A terrific saving in journalistic expenses. They can then run that as their lead story with a reporter's name on it and showing what are apparently objective political findings.
Would you suggest then that people entirely ignore polls, just forget about it?
I think, for example, I mean, it used to be that, and this is only, we're only talking the late and mid-70s, that newspapers like the Boston Globe and the New York Times, for example, had quite big debates in the office about whether or not to commission opinion polls. If they commissioned them, whether to report them on the front page, and if they did that, whether to put the byline of one of their own reporters onto it. In other words, to incorporate it into, let alone to make it the centerpiece of, the newspaper's coverage of public affairs. That debate now seems prehistoric. The most important person in most newspaper offices, and certainly in every network office these days, is the pollster.
What do you think the press should have been looking into about the candidates instead of focusing so much on polls?
Well, if there's a story that I would like to write or see written, and I've tried partly to write it for this next edition of Harper's, it would be called The Invisible Primary, and it's something that actually every paper could report if it wanted to. And I'll tell you in a minute why they don't. What we in the trade call The Invisible Primary is actually a two-stage affair. For a candidate to emerge as a front-runner, he has to win a money primary, and then he has to win a media primary. In neither of these do what are fondly known as the American people have a say, and mostly they don't even know it's going on. The money primary consists of going around groups of anonymous fundraisers who convene for the purpose. One of them is run by an otherwise completely undistinguished Maryland realtor called Nate Landau, who's a very important guy in politics and who no one ever writes about. He and a group of 50 of his friends, who can all kick in quite a lot of money at any time they like, run the rule over candidates who go and have that rule run over them. And they decide who's going to get the money this year. It sounds crude, and it is, but it's true. Then there's a media primary, which is where basically what my friend Eric Altman is writing a book about, it calls the punditocracy, determines who is this year's man of ideas or whatever the cliché is going to be. And this itself has a self-interest to it because these are journalists who depend on access and who are hoping that, especially if the candidate's successful, that access will be theirs. But the access will certainly be theirs for the duration of the campaign. So, again, a sort of unspoken consensus emerges. Flattering profiles are done. Soft question interviews are conducted and so forth. Until Ms. Flowers came on the scene, it was obvious to everyone, and it was the private knowledge of every journalist covering the thing, that Bill Clinton had wrapped up both those invisible primaries. Now, a story about how he did that would really educate and enlighten the people about how politics in this country is conducted. The reason it isn't going to get done is because the press is partly complicit in the running of this invisible primary, which, as I say, takes place without reference to the electors, and is completed before anything is put to them.
How did Clinton get to be the front runner early on in the campaign? Who made him the front runner?
Well, the two sets of primary managers that I mentioned, the fundraisers and donors, and the pundit press, people like David Broder of the Washington Post, who are considered very important kingmakers and mentioners in this kind of thing. They determine, you know, who's going to be in consideration. A test they invariably apply when it's a Democrat is how much does he hate the record and history and principles of the Democratic Party? In other words, how unpredictable is he? If someone runs as a Democrat just because they're a Democrat and believe that the New Deal was a good thing, that's boring, obviously. I mean, there's nothing to write there. What you want is someone who can, and a favorite word always is unpredictable, as it were, trying to move the party to the right, trying to outdo the Republicans in image-making and in promise-giving.
How would you say campaigns then use polls? If polls are the tool of the mass media, how then would a Harkin or a Kerry, a Tsongas, any of these people running for president, how would they then use that information to incorporate into their platform?
Well, it depends what you want to do. I mean, there's a celebrated story about Lee Atwater, for example, in a southern state where he was managing a Republican campaign. And the very strong Democratic challenger was Jewish. And Atwater polled for anti-Semitism. He investigated the electorate to see how many people were prejudiced against Jews. Answer, very many less than he thought. But then he polled again, asking the question, would you vote for a candidate who did not accept Jesus Christ as his personal savior, which is the same question as you can see, but in a slightly different way. The numbers on that went up. Quite a lot of people, if it was put to them in that way, gave a different sort of answer. So he'd found, as it were, the area of vulnerability for a Jewish person to campaign. What then happened, and it was never exactly discovered how much Mr. Atwater had to do with it, was that a sudden third-party person entered the race saying nobody should vote for anyone who didn't accept Jesus Christ as their personal savior. And that had a spoiling effect on the Democratic challenger. That's what you can do with polling. That's how you can predetermine a strategy and get ahead of where the electorate know themselves to be. You might describe that as manipulation. In theory, of course, you could simply do what Harris Wofford did in Pennsylvania and find that the president's pollsters, geniuses as they're supposed to be, had missed. I can't think how they did, but they seem certainly to have missed the incredible public concern about health and health care. And you decide that that's where you'll make your pitch, and you simply have to get used to the sound of your own voice and grit your teeth and go on saying the same thing all the time till everyone's got the point.
Christopher Hitchens is my guest, and he writes a column for The Nation. He's also a Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with journalist Christopher Hitchens. Let's talk a little bit about the Democratic candidates. And do you agree with others who have called them, and we're talking about the five ones that got the most media attention, that would be Tsongas, Kerry, Harkin, Clinton, and Brown, do you see them as lightweights?
Well, I'm not sure if it would be fair to say that any of them were lightweight as individuals. All of them have done or endured fairly impressive things. But it's not possible to describe any of them, with the possible exception of Paul Tsongas, as in any sense men of ideas. And it's not really possible to describe any of them, with the possible exception of Tom Harkin, as obviously Democrats. I'm not sure which of these two observations is the more interesting one. Maybe you should be the judge of that. Maybe neither of them are. But I mean, most striking to me is the fact that all the candidates but Tom Harkin could be running as Republicans.
Well, let me just get back to how someone gets to be a candidate. And it seems to me in the quote-unquote old days that candidates were known before they became candidates. These five men and the many others that were on the Democratic ticket were relatively unknown to people outside their small states. Do you see this as a different process going on?
Well, though I think that that's unfair to Jerry Brown. I think what it is, it's an aspect of the following. The Democratic Party is, before our very eyes, ceasing to exist. It's increasingly losing its rationale, its raison d'etre. Nobody founding a political party now would want to found anything like the Democratic Party of the United States of America. Most of its voters have a very slight attachment to it. Among the younger generation, there's tremendous indifference towards it. Its own managers could mostly be imagined working for the other party, and many of them, under changed circumstances, certainly would do so. Its congressional leadership would, on the whole, rather do business in a power-sharing agreement with a Republican White House than it would have the awkwardness of a Democrat at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Last time there was a Democrat, the Democratic Congress couldn't stand him. That was Jimmy Carter, and helped to get rid of him.
The two Democratic frontrunners, Bill Clinton and Paul Tsongas, seem to speak to and for middle-class issues. Who do you think speaks for the poor?
Well, I think Tom Harkin believes that he does.
Do you believe he does?
No, I don't. I think Tom Harkin is another machine politician. I think if you wanted the quickest thumbnail for Tom Harkin would be his answer to the challenge about let's have no more PAC money in the first Democratic candidates round table. He looked as if a cigar had just blown up in his face. No, he said he would not be prepared to discuss repudiating PAC money, and I don't see why he should. He's probably, I haven't actually got the tabulations in front of me, but he's certainly one of the largest recipients of special interest money in Washington, which makes him some kind of a pro-populist, in my opinion.
So you're saying that nobody speaks for the poor?
No, and increasingly and very distressingly, the poor are not part of the political process at all. They don't register or they can't. Various obstacles are put in their way. They don't know how to, or they don't bother, or because they want to in some way, stay anonymous, perhaps to avoid who knows what, the IRS or something. They just, as it were, drop out of sight. They barely even show up in opinion polls. In large parts of the country, there are third world levels of illiteracy, probably the single biggest national disgrace, although there are several rivals for that title. People who probably couldn't tell you who the president was. And all of these people are increasingly being moved not just out of the economy into a sort of third world existence, but out of politics altogether. So there's no percentage in going after their votes because they're probably not going to vote for anyone. Now, this is an extraordinary state of affairs.
Why do you think that Jerry Brown got only 9% of the vote in New Hampshire? He was calling for systemic changes. He talked about a corrupt system. Is this a message you think the voters wanted to hear about?
Well, it's a message they never really got the chance to hear because from day one, Mr. Brown, or Governor Brown, as I should perhaps call him, was decided by the professionals to not be in the race at all. Again, I don't quite know how that happened, but... to give you an example, in the Washington Post report of the debate in which he had impugned the corporate sponsorship of the program, said he wouldn't take any money more than $100 donations, attacked the Democratic Party's complicity with corruption, mentioned a couple of other awkward subjects like the Iran-Contra scandal and its continuing reverberations, done a number of things none of the other candidates did. The Washington Post's objective news summary, what it put on its front page as its news, described his performance as disruptive. A bizarre way of rating a candidate. Because you have to ask disruptive of what? And why is it, the newspaper's business to pronounce this judgment? That opinion, mutatis mutandis, applied to every other professional commentator, and the industry of polling and professional campaigning and fundraising just decided the guy was a kook, so he couldn't be in. And that was the impression they passed on to the electors. In those circumstances, I'm surprised Brown did as well as he did.
Is there then a chance of redesigning a system then? And you talk about the fact that in Europe people are trying to invent their own democracies based on some of the ideals of our own Democratic Party, which you say don't exist anymore. Do you have any suggestions?
There are three or four things that I think would have to be done if democracy has a chance of surviving in the United States. The first is to make it, in effect, illegal to contribute money to a candidate. In my country of origin, the United Kingdom, If you want to run for parliament, you have to put down a deposit of, it would in dollar terms probably be about $500, which you lose if you don't get a certain percentage of the vote. This is to screen out completely frivolous candidates. It's just a test of seriousness. After that, the post office delivers to everybody's door your campaign literature for free. And the television and radio stations give you equal time with the other candidate for free. And that's it. That's the whole role money plays. And that's too much, in my opinion. So you'd have to just take money and politics and put them in separate worlds. Then I think you would probably have to consider doing what some countries do, which is at least during the final week or so of the campaign to forbid the taking of opinion polls and the publishing of political advertisements. So people could have a chance to reflect and have a chance to put up their own hand, as it were, in the forum, in the assembly we call democracy, without all the time having to look around to see who else's hand is up, which is distracting and vulgar and also is a form of pressure and coercion.
Would you say that then governing in England, you use that as the example, that it's this actually then a less corrupt, more effective system?
Well, I don't want to sound chauvinistic about it. I mean, there's a great deal of corruption in it's not impossible to buy a member of parliament in Britain. But if you are caught giving money to a member of parliament to influence legislation, you and he will both go to jail. It's against the law. It's not against the law to buy a legislator in this country. Indeed, I mean, a legislator who isn't in some sense for sale isn't going to last for long. His whole job is the raising of money. And the only thing he has to sell is his vote or her vote, and that is considered normality here. And it is this, it is to all foreign visitors the single most surprising thing about the United States, probably, apart from the availability of small arms. Well, and indeed, medium-sized weapons too.
Do you get any actual enjoyment watching campaigns, following them around, being in the middle of them?
Well, yes, I do. I have to confess, and I mean confess. I mean, yeah. Yes, it is interesting to be in the press bar in New Hampshire, because you can get the spurious feeling that you're on the inside. That you certainly get to know things before anyone else does, which is the feeling, you know, that one joined the profession of journalism to experience, I suppose. Indeed, I mean, that's one of the reasons I became a journalist was so I wouldn't have to rely on the newspapers for information, and I pity those who do. Because I watch the news stories being written, and I think, boy, if the person who was writing this said what he really knew, but that'll never happen, people would be informed. But there's a sort of filter in operation there.
So the press bar is still an important hangout then?
Yeah, and then you can be wandering in and you trip over a candidate who's sort of at a loose end and shakes your hand and is nice to you because he's not quite sure who you are, and you might be someone who's about to give him some money. Yeah, there's all that. And New Hampshire's an attractive place, after all. I was saying to someone the other day when I came back, if they called it the Cook County primary, everyone would understand what was going on. It's just a racket, basically. But because it's called the New Hampshire primary and everything's taking place in an Andrew Wyeth painting and everything looks sort of authentically and deeply and fully integrally American, this wonderful backdrop, it looks somehow pristine, which is it very much is not.
Thank you so much, Christopher Hitchens, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Glad to be asked. Thanks.
Christopher Hitchens is the Washington editor for Harper's and a columnist for The Nation. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. So George Bush won the Republican primary in New Hampshire yesterday. No surprises there. But lots of people were surprised by how close the race was and how well Pat Buchanan did against Bush. Coming up, syndicated columnist Roger Simon looks at how the New Hampshire results will affect the Bush and Buchanan campaigns, not to mention the campaigns of Tsongas, Clinton, Harkin, Kerry, and Brown. When Albert Murray wrote Train Whistle Guitar, his autobiographical novel about his childhood, it drew comparisons to the adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Book critic John Leonard tells us what he thinks of the new sequel to that book, The Spyglass Tree. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New Hampshire, Republican voters say that they sent President Bush a powerful message in yesterday's primary. Although Mr. Bush was the clear numerical winner, Patrick Buchanan gained enough support to show that the president is open to possible attacks from future challengers. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Manchester.
The front page headline in today's Manchester Union Leader, the state's conservative newspaper, was 3 inches high. Read our lips, it said in capital letters across the page. The Union Leader is credited with helping Buchanan win so much support in New Hampshire. Its daily anti-Bush editorials bolstered Buchanan's 10-week campaign to win enough votes to embarrass the incumbent president. Buchanan's appeal in the state comes from anguish over the economy, a distrust of President Bush, and a resentment that he broke his no new taxes pledge. More than half of the people who voted for Buchanan said they backed him only to send a message of discontent to the president. Buchanan is optimistic he can take his campaign to other states and trigger a conservative revolution aimed at recapturing the heart and soul of the Republican Party. But first, he needs to get his name on the ballot. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Manchester.
State officials in New Hampshire now have President Bush getting 53% of the vote to 37% for Patrick Buchanan. Unofficial media results had put the number at 58% to 40%. Yesterday's Democratic winner in New Hampshire, former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas, headed to Maryland today as he contended that he's more than a regional candidate. Tsongas received 35% of the Democratic primary vote, followed by Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton with 26% of the vote. In New York City, UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali has decided to send one of his aides on a mission to Libya in what may be an attempt to head off economic sanctions. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Libya is currently in a standoff with the UN Security Council, in particular with three permanent members of the Security Council, Britain, France, and the United States. All have demanded that Libya extradite officials accused of planting the bombs that destroyed a Pan-American jet over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1985 and a French UTA airliner over Niger in 1986. Libya has said it would cooperate with the French investigation, but has never made it clear that includes extradition, and it has flatly refused to provide the two men wanted by both Britain and the U.S. There is a draft resolution in the Security Council calling for an embargo on arms sales to Libya and a ban on all commercial aviation links. The UN envoy is reportedly carrying a message warning that the sanctions will be adopted by the end of this month unless Libya complies. This is Neil Conan reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 5 points to close at 3,230.32 on volume of 233 million shares. This is NPR News. Former Irish Republican Army member Joseph Dougherty has been deported to Britain after a 10-year battle to stay in the United States. He faces a life sentence in connection with the murder of a British soldier in Belfast in 1980. The 37-year-old Dougherty was reportedly taken from federal prison in Pennsylvania this morning and put on an airplane headed for London. His supporters say that justice has been sacrificed for the sake of relations with the British government. State Department officials have issued a warning that Americans face an increased risk of terrorist attacks overseas after Israel's assassination of a leading Hezbollah figure. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says the United States is concerned about public threats by Hezbollah against Americans.
Department of State advises American citizens that the killing of Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Abbas Mousawi has increased the security risk to Americans traveling or residing in Europe Africa, and the Middle East. There is a possibility that Americans could be targets of terrorist action, including renewed kidnappings.
The warning comes as fighting continued for the third straight day between Israeli troops and Hezbollah guerrillas in South Lebanon. There were no reports of Lebanese injuries today, but 13 Israelis were treated for shock and injuries, and thousands of Shiite Muslims fled their villages to escape Israeli artillery. I'm Linda Gradstein in Washington.
Judge Clarence Thomas, writing an appeals court opinion before he became a member of the U.S. Supreme Court, has ruled against a government affirmative action program for women. In his ruling, Thomas said that an FCC program favoring women results in reverse discrimination for men. The appeals court panel, by a vote of 2-1, overturned the FCC's decision to give special preference to a Maryland woman who wanted to build a radio station. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Columnist Roger Simon has been traveling around New Hampshire for the past 2 weeks, following the candidates and the voters for a syndicated column that originates at the Baltimore Sun. Simon flew back to Washington this morning and joined us to share his impressions of the first primary of the 1992 presidential campaign. This is the fifth presidential campaign that Simon has covered. Up in New Hampshire, Simon was struck by how little George Bush campaigned. I asked him to describe how the voters felt once Bush finally did show up.
Angry. All of us reporters gather what's called anecdotal evidence, non-scientific evidence, and we knew, all of us on the Bush bus, by talking to each other, but more importantly, talking to members of the crowds that came out for Bush, knew that Patrick Buchanan was going to do much better than the polls. We knew Bush was going to take it in the chops. We knew the polls were wrong, and it's because, one, the crowds were tiny, extremely small for a sitting president. Here's a man with the entire infrastructure of the White House campaign team at his disposal. He couldn't get 150 people in an airplane hangar in New Hampshire, even by busing a lot of them up from Massachusetts. And more importantly, when you went and talked to the people in his crowds, they were Pat Buchanan voters. They were Democrats who were there because their six-year-old wanted to see the president. Or they were people very, very angry with George Bush. Naturally, he had some supporters, but darn few.
How much of the vote for Buchanan was a protest vote against Bush or even against any of the other candidates?
To a large extent, it was a protest vote. The line was that they were using Pat Buchanan as a mailbox. The people of New Hampshire were sending a message to George Bush, and he got the message. Very few of the people in the crowds that I talked to, Buchanan crowds now, covered both candidates, of course, really either wanted or to a greater extent expected Pat Buchanan to be the nominee of the Republican Party.
How would you describe his style of campaigning? And what I think the rest of the nation saw in TV clips was a very enthusiastic audience.
Are you talking about Pat Buchanan now?
Yes.
Pat Buchanan is an excellent campaigner. Makes terrific eye contact with the audience. I know that might sound silly, but it's very important, especially in New Hampshire and other smaller states where you're talking to groups sometimes of 40 and 50 people, not 4,000 to 5,000 people. He knows how to simply work a hall from moving his body from left to center to right. His hand gestures, again, that sounds silly, but let's remember in 1980, when George Bush was first running for president, he went to gesture school in New York to learn how to make his gestures better. Pat Buchanan has terrific gestures. He is capable of pulling off phrases like, my friends, and making it sound not like a demagogue, but like a natural phrase of speech. The excellent speaker, I'm sure from a long time on the speaking circuit and, of course, on television. And quite frankly, he's a very powerful a man in person.
What do you think Pat Buchanan's showing will do to President Bush, who has said he will do anything to be president and is known for having some chameleon-like political stance? Do you expect him to move to the right?
I think that's what people say. That's sort of an easy analysis, but I don't expect it to be true. George Bush is going to be the nominee of the Republican Party. Pat Buchanan is not going to beat him. The Republican Party is not going to nominate Pat Buchanan for president. I'm sorry to disappoint his supporters, but it's simply not going to happen. Republicans, and I'll tell you the reason. It's called the Jesse Jackson effect. 4 years ago, Jesse Jackson did an amazing thing and won the Michigan caucus. And he was on the cover of Newsweek, Time, U.S. News and World Report, and every newspaper in the country. And as soon as people picked up those magazines and those newspapers and turned on their radios and TVs and thought, my God, Jesse Jackson could really win this thing, Jesse Jackson never won another primary. As soon as Pat Buchanan, let's say he beats George Bush in a few more states, that is going to scare Republicans into thinking, number one, he might defeat George Bush and we might have to have a Buchanan versus the Democrat, which would doom us in the fall. Or number two, we might damage George Bush so much in the primary process that even if he is nominated, he will lose to the Democrat. So in a sense, the better Pat Buchanan does from now on, the less of a chance he has of actually winning this thing.
I'm speaking with Roger Simon, and he's a nationally syndicated columnist for the Baltimore Sun, and he's been covering politics for some years now. In fact, started covering presidential politics back in 1976. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Roger Simon. He's a nationally syndicated columnist for the Baltimore Sun, and he's just returned from New Hampshire, where he spent the last 2 weeks following presidential candidates around the country, around the state, rather, for their primary. How do you think Tsongas is going to play around the rest of the country?
Boy, that's the big unknown. At first glance, you would think this guy doesn't have a chance. He's Greek and from Massachusetts. Not only that, but he's had cancer, although his doctor assures everybody he's completely over it now. Does the Democratic Party really need those three things? And then you go beyond that, and in a traditional sense, he is non-charismatic. I happen to find him personally having sort of an anti-charisma that has its own kind of attraction and charm, if you will.
Do you think that's what the voters of New Hampshire got attracted to, his non-charisma charisma?
Yes, I think he really won him over. And let's not forget, he was a senator from a neighboring state. He has lived all his life in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is not far from New Hampshire. He was able to transport quite a few Massachusetts residents into New Hampshire. Tens of thousands of Massachusetts citizens have moved to New Hampshire to escape taxes and have carried their old loyalties with him. But beyond that, the people in his crowds find his non-blow-dried looks, his candor, his promise, not of easy times, but of tough times, they find it refreshing. If the rest of the nation finds it refreshing, he's going to do well. If the rest of the nation says, however, gee, he doesn't look that good, and he speaks kind of with a funny speech defect, and why should I vote for any man who promises me hard times? Well, then his campaign is going to fail very shortly. Maryland, on March 3rd, is going to be a big test of Tsongas.
This is a race in which two people who came in second, Clinton and Buchanan, declared themselves winners. Is this sort of an odd thing, or is this just what politicians do?
It's not just what politicians do. It's what the press aids them in. It's the expectations game, not what did you win. We all know that Bush won, and actually he won by a pretty convincing margin, about 18 points. Tsongas won by 8 points. But the fact that Clinton had come back to do better than expected, the fact that Buchanan did much better than expected, the fact that all the polls were wrong in terms of what they were showing, leads to this impression that they are, in a sense, victors. And if you were in New Hampshire and watched TV or listened to radio on primary night, in fact, you heard 7 victory speeches. Nobody in this race is conceding anything. Jerry Brown finished last with 9%, but he can honestly say he spent no money. He had almost no organization. All he had was that 800 number, and he was within a few points of Kerry and Harkin, who spent a lot of money.
Now, you've been in New Hampshire for 2 weeks. If you can you tell us about if anybody there turned on their radio at any time, was it politics, politics, politics? Same with television and the newspaper?
Yes. New Hampshire is again, I said idiosyncratic, and that's true. People are really into politics in New Hampshire. The only state, I'm sure there are other states, but the only state that I think is similar from my personal experience is Illinois, especially Chicago, where politics is a spectator sport. You grow up reading about politics the same way you read about football or baseball or basketball.
So literally there were politicians and their aides and their handlers and their spin doctors just crawling all over New Hampshire?
Yes, it was an amazing scene on the streets in the last couple of days where the campaigns decided to just get masses of volunteers to go on street corners and at exit ramps of the expressway with their signs and just wave them at each other. But since you had seven major campaigns, and I might add there were 62 presidential names on the ballot when you count the minor candidates, you had these huge crushes of people just madly waving different colored signs at each other from across street corners. It had a festive air. The press rarely writes about it, but New Hampshire is fun. We have a good time up there. I know the press tends to be sort of sardonic and sarcastic about what it does for a living, but it is a kick to be able to get out of bed and grab any candidate you want.
Well, now, would you say the candidates, all 62 of them, were having fun? We can think about the TV appearances, of course, with the makeup and the nice lighting and perhaps a good night's sleep beforehand. But what were some of the bleary-eyed candidate experiences that you saw?
Well, they're all sick, and they always get sick. I don't mean seriously ill, but if you've ever done a back of the limousine or back of the car interview with the candidates, which is a common way of getting an interview as he goes from one stop to the other, the back of all these cars look like pharmacies. There is every nostrum, every over-the-counter cold remedy you have ever seen. There are tissues and cough drops, and it's a grueling, extremely grueling experience for them, with the exception, I might add, of Paul Tsongas, who took it rather easy. He was criticized for it. But he had, in the last critical days, he almost stopped campaigning, and he had a very easy last day. And when asked why, he said, look, I spent time with my family. I spent time reading a book. I spent time thinking about the issues, and that's the way I'm going to campaign. Naturally, there were questions raised as to his health. He said, absolutely not. I'm no more sick than any of the other candidates in terms of being hoarse or in terms of having a cough, and his doctor backed him up on it. I think in retrospect, he might campaign a little more energetically in the future.
Journalist and columnist Roger Simon is my guest. Is it too early to tell in this 92 election campaign to see whether there's some comparisons you can make with the 88 election campaign?
It's not too early to tell in the case of George Bush. George Bush was in real trouble in 1988. He had lost Iowa. If he had lost New Hampshire, he would have been eliminated from the race. So in the space of about 48 hours, he was reshaped and retooled. He was no longer the patrician son of a U.S. senator who liked to drink martinis and play golf. All of a sudden, he was a guy who played horseshoes and ate pork rinds. And they fashioned him into the regular guy. They ran what's called the See Me, Touch Me, Feel Me campaign. They dropped the ropes. People got close to him. The Secret Service moved back. Bush took off, literally, his jacket and tie. He wore sweaters. He wore a Patagonia windbreaker, which was lined with Kevlar. But one of the worst things you can have in a campaign is called TMBS, too many blue suits. And he got the blue suits away. Well, after he won, that was no longer a problem. We don't really expect our presidents to be regular guys. Horseshoes disappeared. He plays golf. He goes out on his speedboat. He doesn't eat pork rinds anymore. When he lands in Air Force One. He has many, many blue suits. But in New Hampshire, and usually that's fine. That's the aura of the office, and it can't even help you. But in New Hampshire, where times are rough, and people are out of work, and people are losing their homes through foreclosure, they resented the trappings of power. And there was no way, after 4 years of being a sitting president under extreme scrutiny, that George Bush can reshape himself again. Now he is what he is, and he's either going to have to stand or fall on it.
You've been involved as a columnist, reporter in presidential campaigns for almost 20 years now. Does New Hampshire have anything to do with the rest of the country?
No, not really. I'm sorry. It's a very nice place.
You just spent 2 weeks there.
and I'm there every 4 years. It is a very nice place. The people are charming. It is a beautiful state. It has virtually no minorities in it. It's now considerably worse off than the rest of the nation. 4 years ago, it was considerably better off than the rest of the nation. It lacks large cities. There are many states, many, many states that are far more representative of the nation as a whole than New Hampshire. But somebody has to be first. New Hampshire is it. It's where the press is going to begin, and it's where most of us go to begin. But we should really keep in mind that this is a very long process. We have elected, or the people of New Hampshire have elected 18 out of the 4,200 delegates necessary, and consumers of news, listeners, viewers, readers, should not be whipsawed back and forth by headlines and sound bites. They should see this as a long process that's going to go on to June 2nd and possibly beyond.
You said that New Hampshire residents love, they live politics. Do you think they're also glad to be rid of you and all those politicians?
Yeah, I think so.
Get back to normal?
Not just us, but not just the press, but you're right about the politicians. They get phone calls from all the candidates. If you're a registered Democrat, you're going to get 20 to 50 phone calls. You're going to get people knocking on your door. You're going to get people going to your plant gate. Then those are just candidates and their surrogates. Then you get the press on top of it. I think New Hampshire gets about $100 million from the press every 4 years, and they certainly like that. But they're real happy we're gone right now.
Roger Simon, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Roger Simon's a nationally syndicated columnist for the Baltimore Sun. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. The day after the election in New Hampshire, we'll have reports and analysis from that state. Michael Scholar reports on the second day of the hearings about breast implants being held by the Food and Drug Administration. Alice Furlow recalls skiing in the mountains as a student in France in 1949, very close to where the Albertville Olympic Games are being held. I can tell you she thinks it's very much different these days. Also a visit to Superior, Wisconsin, a small town that produced the U.S. Olympic curling team, made up of a pair of fathers and sons, now competing in France. They beat Sweden yesterday and France today.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In his first novel, Train Whistle Guitar, writer Albert Murray spun a yarn in the tradition of other Southern writers like William Faulkner, Eudora Welty, and Mark Twain, telling the story of Scooter, a young boy living in a small Southern town. Now Scooter has grown up in the new novel, The Spyglass Tree. Book critic John Leonard's been following Scooter's progress. Here's his review.
The Spyglass Tree picks up just where Guitar left off, with young Scooter on his way, by scholarship, from Gasoline Point near Mobile on the Alabama Gulf Coast to the black college at Tuskegee during the Depression. He is one of the talented 10th, those splendid young men picked out as early as the second grade by teachers and the rest of the black community to make folks proud. The precious few, he's told, that gotta make up for the many. Not for Scooter, nor for Albert Murray, the black man as victim, as martyr, or as pathology. Looking down from his spyglass tree at the briar patch he left behind, he sees a community that nurtured him through childhood. Fairy godmothers and demanding mentors. The teacher, Lexine Metcalf, who asks, who, if not you? And the baseball umpire, Judge Doc the Hawk, who explains in Shade's tonsorial parlor, "Now I'm going to tell you something once and for all about the shame and the blame. If you got the problem and don't buckle down and come up with a solution, hang your own goddamn head in shame. And if you go all the way through college and don't come back with some answers, shame on all of us." Scooter takes textures with him to Tuskegee as well. Dog fennel meadows and crepe myrtle blossoms, a crawfish pond, a streetcar loop, and a pecan orchard. Salt air, cypress bayou, mattress moss, oysters and gumbo. And he brings with him, too, a density of culture. Chickawas, Choctaws, Creoles and Cajuns, buccaneers and runaway slaves, back alley bones rollers and barbershop politics, the upward mobility of the Pullman Porter and the buffalo soldiers of the old 10th Cavalry, the Underground Railroad, and, of course, the blues. What Scooter gets at Tuskegee, where former fugitive slaves started their own college on the grounds of an old plantation, is equally complicated, and I won't spoil it with too much synopsis. But it includes, on the one hand, Egypt and Rome and Chaucer and Faulkner, Proust and Joyce and Sherlock and Cellini, Thorsten Veblen and Frederick Jackson Turner, André Malraux and Roger Fry. On the other hand, it also includes his remarkable roommate Snake and the boss lady blues singer Hortense Hightower, who gives him a bass fiddle, and the high-rolling entrepreneur Giles Cunningham, who gives him a job and a gun. And always there's the music. Bessie Smith and Duke Ellington, Ethel Waters and Count Basie, Ma Rainey and Jelly Roll Morton, Miss Blue Eula and Louis Armstrong. I've sorted some of this out. Murray is all mix, as if to improvise on one theme while the next sneaks up on him. Jazzy, yes, but also symphonic, into what he calls the also and also of whatever, wherever, in which he promises to make myself worthy. A forthcoming third volume will take Scooter north. His publisher calls Train Whistle Guitar a blues version of Tom Sawyer, and The Spyglass Tree a riff on James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Fair enough. I'm reminded as well of Wole Soyinka's Ake and Vladimir Nabokov's Speak Memory. Out of a passionate past, Murray imagines the heroic self.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Spyglass Tree by Albert Murray, published by Pantheon. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Today's show was directed by Sue Spolin. I'm Marty Moscowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, our previously scheduled interviews with Edward Villella and Nancy Lieberman Klein. They both made it in fields usually the domain of the opposite sex, Villella in the world of ballet, and Lieberman Klein on the basketball court. That and more on the next Fresh Air.